WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Legendary folk singer Pete Seeger died yesterday at the age of 94. A towering voice in American song and social activism, he presided over the revival of folk music in this country, mentored artists like Bob Dylan and Joan Baez, and was an inspiration to generations of Americans looking for change and social justice. Pete Seeger's career stretched more than 70 years. We spoke to him back in 2003 about his life, his music, his conscience. He had just released his first new single in years called Take It From Dr. King. Today we bring you that conversation. This hour on Point, the great Pete Seeger. He started off our discussion by describing what he saw as his place in musical history.
Well, I look upon myself as a link in a long chain of people who like to make music, and let's hope there's many links to come. I was at a friend's house just last night rehearsing, and she was listening to Michael Row the Boat Ashore, and yeah. I realized I was one of the links that brought that song around. A friend of mine found it in an old songbook published in 1867.
All right.
Taught it to me, and I put it on a record. Next thing you know, summer campers all over the country were singing it.
Oh, I must have sung it 500 times. It really did frame a whole era, and I want to talk about the spirit that so much of that music captured tonight, how it lined up with the decades you've lived through, how it lines up with our times now. But I don't want to in any way ignore the song you've just come out with and trace its root back to your relationship with Dr. King and We Shall Overcome. You've got a brand new song, Pete Seeger, at 84, called Take It From Dr. King. Tell us about the song.
Well, right after the terrible bombing at September 11th, some ideas occurred to me for a chorus. It's a very jazzy, syncopated little chorus. I played the tune on the banjo and didn't know what the heck to do with it, and all of a sudden I had words. Then I had the trouble of trying to make up verses that were not too teachy-preachy and told some kind of a story. It took me about 6 months.
No kidding.
Yeah, and finally, the third graders in my hometown sang it, and it worked out well with them. I've sung it in other places since then and finally put it in Sing Out magazine so that other people could learn it. And let's hope this record now will be heard.
Well, I'm sure it will. It's coming out on CD. Let's listen to a little bit of Pete Seeger's brand new song, Take It From Dr. King.
Down in Alabama, 1955, not many of us here today were then alive. A young Baptist preacher led a bus boycott. He showed the way for a brand new day without firing a shot.
Don't say it can't be done. The battle's just begun. Take it from Dr. King, you too can learn to sing, so drop the gun.
You can sing it with us.
Don't say it can't be done. The battle's just begun. Take it from Dr. King, you too can learn to sing, so drop the gun.
Oh, those months have been an exciting 13 years. Young heroes, young heroines. There was laughter, there was tears.
Pete Seeger, this song instantly catches one facet of what I see in all of your work, which is you're not trying to impress us with great complexity. You're trying to bring us a straightforward message.
Well, this is what I learned from Woody Guthrie, the fellow who wrote This Land Is Your Land. He had the genius of simplicity. One of his children's songs he made up for his own kid when she was about 3 years old or 2 years old. Put your finger in the air, in the air. Put your finger in the air, in the air. Put your finger in the air. Hold it up right there. Put your finger in the air, in the air. You can't say, what? What on earth do you mean that's a song? Second verse is put your finger on your nose. That's where the cold wind blows.
But when you put a finger in the air, there's a lot you can feel if you pay attention.
Well, I've never failed to get a crowd of little kids putting their finger up in the air. Then put the finger on the nose, put the finger on the chin, that's where the food slips in. And I now believe that if there's a human race here in 100 years, this will be translated into, Lord knows, Swahili and Chinese and other places, just because it's a fun song to teach your child.
Don't say it can't be done. The battle's just begun.
Talk to us about your new song. The refrain is, you too can learn to sing, so drop the gun. You refer specifically to September 11th. You say, since September 11th, many wonder, will this world survive? But if the world learns the lessons from Dr. King, we can survive. We can, we will, and so we sing. Drop the gun. That's a simple phrase. Give us the full meaning.
Well, you know, a song is not a speech, and I often think of a song as a basketball backboard, and it bounces back different meanings mm-hmm. as the experiences of your life bounce against it. I feel that I learned a tremendous amount from Dr. King. I was 36 years old when the bus boycott was started, and the fact that he didn't, some people say, why didn't you tackle something important like voting or schools or health or jobs or housing? Why do you start with the bus boycott? Mm-hmm. I decided that this is a very important political lesson. When you face an opponent over a broad field, you don't pick out the opponent's strong points. You try and take over some little weak point on the edge somewhere, but you take it over. You don't just make an attempt to take it over. And holding the African-American people of Montgomery together for 13 months was real genius. King had to bring the cautious conservative ones together with the angry radical ones and say, if we don't stick together, we will not win. Sometimes he'd stop right in the middle of something and say, let's take a whole day to discuss this, or 2 days if necessary, till we can agree on what our program should be.
But let's be together. And Pete Seeger, you brought to Martin Luther King the song that became the anthem of his movement, that still stands for that movement, that era today, We Shall Overcome. Tell us where this song came from and how it came to be the anthem, how it came to Martin Luther King's attention.
Well, there's an old gospel song, probably made up back in the 19th century, which has one verse in it called I'll Overcome Someday. Mm. It's usually sung as I'll be all right. I'll be all right. I'll be all right someday. And another verse will be, I'll wear the crown, I'll be like him.
Right.
But one verse says, I'll overcome someday. Now, way back almost a century ago, maybe more than a century, they turned it into a union song as We Will Overcome. I've seen a copy of a United Mine Workers Journal of 1908 saying, last year at our meetings, we started each meeting with a prayer and then singing that good old union song, We Will Overcome.
So how did it go? How did it make the leap then through your hands from that to Martin Luther King's ears?
Well, in 1946, a group of tobacco workers, about 300 women, were working for the American Tobacco Company in Charleston, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. It was wintertime and they were on strike. And on the picket line, they'd keep their spirits up by singing hymns. And one woman, Lucille Simmons was her name, liked to sing this very slowly. Maybe she's the one who introduced it slowly. And a white woman, a union organizer, learned it from her and taught it to me. Uh-huh. And other people learned it from this white woman. Her name was Zilphia Horton. She's dead now. Had a beautiful alto voice. And a man named Guy Carawan is actually the man who introduced it to the civil rights movement. He was working in Tennessee. They had a workshop called Singing in the Movement. And people were there from Texas and Florida and Virginia and all around. They sang fast songs and slow songs and new songs and old songs. And somewhere along the line, he taught them, We Shall Overcome.
We shall live in peace.
What did Dr. King think of this song when he heard it?
Actually, he'd heard it 3 years before when I sang it someplace. He was speaking, and a friend of mine drove him to a speaking engagement the following night, and she remembers him sitting in the back seat saying, We Shall Overcome. That song really sticks with you, doesn't it? But he wasn't a song leader. It was my friend Guy Carawan, who taught it to 70 or 80 young people. And a month later, at Raleigh, North Carolina, they had the founding convention of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Yes.
SNCC for short.
Yep.
And somebody shouted out, "Guy, teach us all We Shall Overcome." Well, a month later, it was all around the country. And they worked out a way of crossing their hands in front of their bodies. So
yes.
Your left hand grasped the right hand of the person to your right. And your right hand grasped the hand of the left hand of the person to your left. So your shoulders touch and you sway slightly back and forth while you're singing.
We're re-airing this hour our interview with the legendary folk music champion and activist Pete Seeger. He joined us back in 2003. Pete Seeger died yesterday at the age of 94. You can share your memories of Pete Seeger on Facebook at On Point Radio and at our website, onpointradio.org. After the break, we'll hear more from my interview with the great Pete Seeger. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We are listening back in this hour to my 2003 interview with the legendary folk musician Pete Seeger. He died yesterday at 94. Here's Waist Deep in the Big Muddy, Seeger's song famously censored from television in 1967 due to its clear anti-Vietnam War message, each verse ending with the line, "The big fool said to push on."
It was back in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. Well, the sergeant said, "Sir, are you sure this is the best way back to the base?" "Sergeant, go on, I forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging, we'll soon be on dry ground." We were waist-deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. Well, the sergeant said, "Sir, with all this equipment, no man will be able to swim." "Sergeant, don't be nervous, Nelly," the captain said to him. "All we need is a little determination. Men, follow me, I'll lead on." We were neck deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on.
Pete Seeger, there you are with a song that, from everything I read, was written in anger. It's written about war. It's written about World War II, but in protest of Lyndon Baines Johnson's war in Vietnam. Can you take us back to when you wrote that song and what moved you to write it?
Well, let me say first that I think it's a great tragedy that Johnson found himself in this situation. He didn't know how to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the better presidents we've had. In 1965, it was he who got on the radio and said, "Not only Negroes in the South, but all of us in America will benefit by getting rid of this legacy of oppression and injustice, and we shall overcome."
Picking up that refrain, even in his speech, and we grant him that big picture. But at this moment in history, with Iraq looming, we're interested in politics and war.
Well, way back in 1954, I remember reading when the French were being kicked out of Vietnam by the Viet Cong. I remember reading that, well, USA is going to move in there because we need the tungsten. Tungsten you can find in Vietnam and China, which at that time was now a communist country. So
a metal critical in fighter jets and all kinds of armaments.
That's right. Well, things step by step by step over the decade, it got worse and worse. And I had first tried making up a story song out of a letter in my local newspaper. A woman said, "Dear editor, what's our country coming to? My husband wrote me a letter from Vietnam a month ago, said it's my own troops I have to watch out for. I sleep with a pistol under my head. Mm. We've got a few generals on our side, but they just want our guns." Mm. Last week, My husband was killed, and his casket came home today. Well, I turned it into a song. He said, we've no friends here, no hardly a one. We've got a few generals who just want our guns. Mm. However, it wasn't a song people could join in on, and I always liked a song that has some kind of a refrain.
It's a Pete Seeger trademark.
And I tried making a song that, if you love your Uncle Sam, bring him home, bring him home. Support our boys in Vietnam, bring him home, bring him home. But it was too teachy-preachy. It was more of an editorial in rhyme, which is a dangerous thing for a songwriter. You want to tell a story or paint a picture in some way. All of a sudden, I got a phrase. One whole line appeared, the tune and the words all at once. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Mm. I saw a photograph in a newspaper of American troops wading across the Mekong with life jackets, holding guns high. And I knew it was a good idea. I get about 20 ideas for songs for every one I finish.
Yeah.
And usually write 20 full songs for every one that somebody else finds worth singing. But this took me about 2 weeks, and I got it finished, and by gosh, was able to sing it on the Smothers Brothers comedy show.
Just barely. The network tried to get you off or keep you off.
Actually, the first time I did it, they scissored my song out of the tape, and the Smothers Brothers took their complaints to the print media, and by gosh, the whole country knew that the song had been censored. So finally, 3 months later, I think it was January 1948, Columbia Broadcasting System, okay, you can have them sing the song. And I flew out to the West Coast and sang it along with a batch of other songs. I think I sang Yankee Doodle and John Brown's Body and my favorite song of all time by soldiers. It's called The D-Day Dodgers, written by British soldiers in Italy. Hilariously funny in the beginning and then deeply tragic in the end.
As so many songs of peace are, and Pete Seeger, you've written and sung so many. Americans are right now grappling with Iraq. A lot of confusion about where to stand on it. Some are standing up to protest. Song has always been a part of war protest. You arranged a song called How Can I Keep From Singing. I want to listen to just a bit of that and then
sure.
Get your thoughts on war protest.
My life flows on in endless song, above earth's lamentation. I hear the real, though far off, hymn that hails a new creation. Through all the tumult and the strife, I hear that music ringing. It sounds an echo in my soul. How can I keep from singing? What though the tempest round me roars, I know the truth, it liveth. What though
Pete Seeger singing How Can I Keep From Singing.
You should listen to Enya's record, the Irish singer.
Yes.
She sold 6 million copies of a recording of that song.
You did her a big favor, and she your song a big honor, I guess.
The song was written around 1850 or 1855. And at the time I recorded it, I didn't know it was written by a woman who lived only 6 miles from where I live today, on a little island across from West Point in the Hudson River. The woman who taught it to me was from the Deep South. Well, not too deep. She was from North Carolina.
Yeah.
And she taught it to me, said that this was my grandmother's favorite song. And she taught it to me. She didn't tell me that she'd made up the great third verse, when tyrants tremble sick with fear and hear their death knells ringing, when friends rejoice both far and near, how can I keep from singing?
How can I keep from singing? in prison cell and dungeon vile, our thoughts to them are winging. When friends by shame are undefiled, how can I keep from singing?
Back here once again, I'm very glad to have been a link in a chain to bring this song back.
Pete Seeger, bring that chain forward with us. Look forward down the chain, if you can imagine. In the 60s, when you were singing this song, Vietnam was the war. Now, here we are. It's a new century, and we have a potential new war in front of us. We love your music, but we know you're a thinker as well. Could you have imagined then that the U.S. would be in this kind of world-straddling military power projection position today? Is this just fundamental to what we are, or did you have a different dream?
America's a mixed-up nation, of course, as you know. And as Nixon once said, it's a nation of vociferous minorities and silent majorities. Mm-hmm. But I honestly do believe that if there's a human race here in 100 years, we're going to learn from these disasters and learn that in the long run, King was right, that we are going to be able to survive if we can learn ways to cool it. Now, how to cool things in Iraq, I won't say an exact prescription, but for one thing, you know, there's a lot of ways you can influence people without using guns. Mm-hmm. And yet we our government does it all the time. Way back when Clinton was president, they sent guided missiles from a warship in the Red Sea to pinpoint targets in Kabul, Afghanistan, and Khartoum in the Sudan, Africa. Mm-hmm. Well, it was a miracle of technology, but when they got there, it was one more piece of military stupidity. They dropped some bombs. What they could have done would drop leaflets, maybe with pictures on it for people who can't read too well, showing them what their own stupid male leaders are doing. Mm-hmm. And I honestly believe this is what should have been done when Hitler took over Germany. You see, the first country that a dictator conquers is his own country. Mm-hmm. And when Hitler closed down on freedom of speech and freedom of the press, I think the rest of the world ought to send into the German people leaflets of some sort, letting him know how Hitler started and what he was really up to.
So don't give up on the conversation. Never give up on the dialogue.
Yeah. Incidentally, speaking of Hitler, I was in Latin America in Nicaragua and read a poem in Spanish. Now, I don't know Spanish well enough to remember the Spanish, but I remember the translation. And the name of the poem was The Young Art Student. And the first line says, the young art student was painting what he was sure would be his masterpiece. Brushstroke after brushstroke, he knew it was going to win a prize. No, it did not win a prize. It didn't even get honorable mention. In fact, he heard through the grapevine the judges had laughed at it. The young art student gritted his teeth, clenched his hands till the nails bit into his palms. He said, someday those people will pay for this. And 30 years later, 6 million died.
Pete Seeger, I want to ask you a favor. We are in the 21st century now. You've lived a life that's been blessed with many years, and it goes back deep into the 20th century, into a time that many of our listeners have no experience of, can scarcely imagine, the 30s and 40s when you were growing up and knew well and very active. Give us your nutshell bio to convey to a young listener's ears today the course of a life like yours in a century that they will little know.
Well, first of all, the 1920s were prosperous. They said if you had $25 and could afford a piece of stock, it would double itself in 2 years.
So there's an echo we know there.
And then in 1929, the whole thing crashed. I remember before that, though, I was as dumb as any young person. In our little school, we had a kind of a mock election in 1928, And I wanted to be like everybody else. I didn't want to stand out like a sore thumb. I said, who's everybody voting for? And they said, oh, we're voting for Hoover. So I voted for Hoover. Later on, I found out my roommate had voted for a guy named Norman Thomas. I said, who's he? I thought the election was between Hoover and Smith. Oh, Norman Thomas is a socialist, doesn't get many votes, but he ran. Well, later on, I learned I ran a school newspaper from about age 12, and then in another school, I got a scholarship there by running it. And later on in college, I helped run a little journal.
And you had heroes who were journalists, muckrakers, and the editor of the New Masses, the official newspaper of the Communist Party in the U.S., Mike Gold.
I was a closet lefty, but it was understandable in those days when Hitler really got going. Mm-hmm. The question was what to do about it. Now, some people were strict pacifists. I have pacifists in my family. Mm-hmm. But I didn't agree with them. I said, somebody's got to stop Hitler in some way. I spent 3.5 years in World War II, mm-hmm. went out to the island of Saipan. But the joke is, you know, yeah. other people got shot up and everything. What did I do in World War II? I played the banjo.
And you had become very good by the time of World War II. Woody Guthrie was part of your inspiration. You'd seen Lead Belly and seen a lot of the real folk music roots of America. By the 40s, you were singing with the Weavers and making a splash.
That was quite unexpected. Lee Hayes, who was the son of an Arkansas preacher, had taught me songs like Saints Go Marching In and Amazing Grace, and they really needed a group to sing them right. And we knew a couple other people who were good singers. Ronnie Gilbert had a glorious alto voice, and Fred Halliman, a good baritone. So we put together a little group, but we were about to break up because we didn't get any jobs until finally I got a job in a small nightclub in Greenwich Village. Believe it or not, our salary was $200 a week for all four of us.
All right.
And free hamburgs. However, the owner of the club came in a month later and saw the size of the hamburgs I was making for everybody. He said, let's make that $250 a week, but no more free hamburgs.
We got to cut down on that. By the 50s, and I know we're leaping here, but our time is short, you were sitting in 1955 before the House Un-American Activities Committee. You ended up blacklisted along with lots of left-leaning artists of that day and narrowly escaped prison.
Well, I didn't use the Fifth Amendment. I said, I don't think these are questions that any American should be forced to answer, especially under threat of reprisal if they give the wrong answer. So I just clammed up. My lawyer made the defense on the basis of the First Amendment, which basically says you have a right to your own opinion. And the judge didn't agree with my lawyer and sentenced me to a year in jail, but my lawyer got me out on bail, and a year later, the appeals court acquitted me, saying, they covered themselves and said, we are not inclined to lightly disregard charges of unconstitutionality, even though they may be made by those unworthy of our respect.
We're listening back this hour to my 2003 interview with the great folk musician Pete Seeger. Seeger died on Monday at 94. His career was one of politics as well as music. He sang for the labor movement, for civil rights and environmental protection, against war, for peace. He wrote and adapted songs of protest, songs of longing, songs of determination. If I Had a Hammer, Where Have All the Flowers Gone? Turn, 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 and above all, We Shall Overcome, which Seeger adapted from old spirituals. He was blacklisted in the McCarthy era, which he saw as a badge of honor. When we come back, more of that 2003 conversation. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Our faith cries out, they shall not pass. We cry, no passer on. We pledge our lives, our honor all free. Our native...
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Legendary folk musician Pete Seeger died yesterday at 94. We're listening back to my interview with him from 2003. Pete Seeger served as an inspiration to generations of musicians. At Seeger's star-studded 90th birthday concert back in 2009, Bruce Springsteen introduced Seeger as a living archive of America's music and conscience, a testament of the power of song and culture to nudge history along. Seeger received the National Medal of the Arts in 1994, the highest award for an artist given by the U.S. government. He played on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial at the first inauguration of President Obama. Pete Seeger once said, "My job is to show folks there's a lot of good music in this world, and if used right, it may help save the planet." I spoke to him back in 2003. Here's Seeger's song, "To Everyone in All the World."
To everyone in all the world, I reach my hand, I shake their hand. To everyone in all the world, I shake their hands like this. All together, the whole wide world around. I may not know your lingo, but I can say by jingo, no matter where you live, we can shake hands. All together, the whole wide world around. I may not know your lingo, but I can say by jingo, no matter where you live, we can shake hands.
Pete Seeger singing "To Everyone in All the World," and you hear that classic Pete Seeger sound. Sound that makes you want to hold the hand of the person next to you and sing out at the refrain. Pete Seeger, it's always great. In the 60s, you really became an icon, even though you were not a child of the 60s by any means. What was it that so caught fire? What was the germ you brought forward from the 30s and the 40s that just captured that imagination and record albums in the 60s?
Well, I've always loved to sing for kids. I started in 1968 or 38 or 39, mm-hmm. and I still sing for schools. You can't say there's no hope when you look at all those little faces. And that was actually a children's song. But I think grown-up songs can also use a little bit of that same spirit of join in, have some fun. And I purposely made this song about Dr. King, a song you can dance to. A lot of peace songs are slow and thoughtful,
yeah.
but decided to make this one something that a jazz trumpeter could enjoy playing.
And a 10-year-old could jitter around and have a lot of fun. Here we are. We're years on now from the 60s. Another war potentially looms. I read that one of the things that you tell American children when you speak with them today is do not trust the media. I want to understand that.
Well, you know what? You have to read between the lines no matter what you're reading.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bad habit that the media has to give us the bad news. In newspapers, they say, if it doesn't bleed, it doesn't lead. And I would like to see some of the good stories told. There are more good stories going on in America today, I believe, than ever in history. Have you ever told the story of Granny D?
Tell us.
A woman 90 years old who walked from Los Angeles to Washington with a banner saying, "Election Campaign Reform."
That's a long walk.
She walked 10 miles a day. It took her 14 months, but she did it. And she had a laptop. When she got near Washington, she tapped out a little note saying, and sent it to several thousand people. She'd kept their names and addresses. If you want to join me the last 5 miles, be at Arlington Cemetery next Thursday at 9 a.m. 2,200 people showed up. She gave them a short speech. "These men died for our democracy. And what's happening in Washington? You can't get elected unless you raise millions of dollars." And they walked across the Potomac down to the Capitol, and she stood on the steps of the Capitol saying, "These houses of Congress are being turned into houses of prostitution." She's a great person, Granny D. She's 92 now.
And there's your shining story and your sharp lick all at the same time. Pete Seeger, what is it that you want young Americans today to know about the history, the roots, the sentiments and outlook that Americans have had in decades before them, going back even to your youth? Are there things that are the signals that are weak today that they need to be reminded of, that they need to feel again? There's a kind of clarity and clearness and almost purity in a lot of the songs you sing.
I believe that people working together in groups. I believe in small business, small churches, small unions even, and small scientific groups and small cultural groups. We have a little club in my hometown called the Beacon Sloop Club, which helps the Sloop Clearwater clean up the Hudson River. And every June, we have the world's best strawberry shortcake festival.
And it doesn't take a big group to make a strawberry shortcake. Are we getting back to that? People talk about technology and the internet allowing smaller congregations of people again.
Listen, do you know, I've got something you should remember. This world is going to be saved by technology saving the world before big technology wipes it out. It'll be small technology which saves it when big technology often doesn't know what to do and does the wrong thing.
We can hope for that. And when you sit with children today, do you get that same feeling of hope? Do they have the same get up and go that you've always seen?
I wish you could have heard the third graders in my hometown sing Take It From Dr. King last spring. It was beautiful. In fact, they were dancing while they did it.
How's your banjo picking these days at 84, Pete Seeger?
Oh, it's slowed down. I listened to things I used to play 25 years ago and said, how the heck did I play it that fast? But I still like to pick a banjo.
And do you still have the same inscription on that banjo?
This machine surrounds hate and forces it to surrender. I hope.
We hope. We all hope. Pete Seeger, it's just been terrific talking with you tonight. And thank you for your new song, Take It From Dr. King. Thank you for being there, and thank you for all the songs I had around the campfire and thousands of our listeners have as well. We are grateful to you, and always will be.
Thank you, Tom. Bye.
The great Pete Seeger from our conversation 10 years ago this month, January 2003. He died yesterday at 94. In a moment, we'll talk live about Pete Seeger's life and legacy. This is On Point. Joining us now, live in 2014 from Atlanta, Georgia, is folk singer and storyteller John McCutcheon. Pete Seeger once said of him, John McCutcheon is not only one of the best musicians in the USA, but also a great singer, songwriter, and song leader. John McCutcheon, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. It's nice to talk to you again.
Also with us from Middletown, Connecticut, is Rob Rosenthal, sociology professor at Wesleyan University. He and his son, Sam Rosenthal, worked with Pete Seeger on the big book, Pete Seeger, His Life in His Own Words, which came out last year. Rob Rosenthal, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, we're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. John McCutcheon, just to listen back to him in that segment from 10 years ago, my heart wells up. What a man. What a life.
Pete was a force of nature. I remember discovering him. The first album I ever bought was the day my youngest brother was born. I went out to celebrate and bought the album that actually was played as part of this, We Shall Overcome. It was a live concert in June of 1963 in Carnegie Hall. And it was I was just interested in the song, We Shall Overcome. Didn't know who Pete was. I listened to this, and it was a transformative experience because it was a live concert and the best instrument that Pete played, and he was a marvelous instrumentalist, was the audience. You sat there, and even people who believed they couldn't sing sang. You believed you meant nothing and you felt powerful. You believed that you were all on your own thinking and believing the things you thought, and suddenly you were surrounded by this big force. And it made me think about how I want to do my job differently, certainly. And if it wasn't for Pete, so many of us wouldn't have the job we have.
You know, it was the soundtrack of my youth, sort of at the mother's knee, at campfires and everywhere else. Rob Rosenthal, Pete Seeger alluded to it in the conversation we just heard with him from 2003, but remind us of his philosophy of how folk music and the sing-along of the audience and politics went together.
Yeah, I think that's one of the really profound things about Pete. First, that for him, music wasn't something, an escape away from a non-fulfilling daily life, but it was a way in which we could struggle for a more fulfilling daily life for everyone. It was part of that life. It wasn't just something you escaped into. And And the way in which he did it was so different than most people. That is, he had this incredible democratic thrust to it. He wanted the audience to be the artist. He didn't want to split. He didn't want to be up there on the stage, the great artist, looking down on the audience. He didn't want to sing to people. He wanted to sing with people. And he was happiest when the audience took the lead, because he thought that that's truly democracy in practice, when people think, I am the one who's responsible, I am the one who's going to do this. And it was obviously also a metaphor for politics, but it was crucial to him in terms of performance.
John McCutcheon, how did you see his influence down through the decades? It's hard to remember where folk music was in a wilderness before Pete Seeger, on the back of Woody Guthrie, you know, brought it back. How do you see his influence in the decades that followed?
Well, for one thing, he introduced America to a body of common music. I mean, if you look at what Bruce Springsteen did with the Seeger sessions, there was, with the exception of We Shall Overcome, there was no politics there. But the fact that people from all walks of life and all ages suddenly could be singing the Erie Canal was a profoundly political act. And the fact that he was able to bring to stand up to the cult of personality. As Rob said, it was not about him. He turned the whole notion of what a concert was, what a performance was, on its head. And people know Pete Seeger's music without knowing it. I mean, I'm a songwriter. One of the greatest compliments I can imagine is having people not know that you wrote Where Have All the Flowers Gone, or co-wrote If I Had a Hammer, things that people just think have always been there.
They seem like absolute bedrock and such brightness in them. This was a little tape from 2009 at the first inauguration of President Obama, accompanied by Bruce Springsteen and many others, Pete Seeger performing Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land.
As I went walking the ribbon of highway,
just great. John McCutcheon, Rob Rosenthal. We've got people writing in, just pouring in here. Let me just read some of the things people are writing to us. Dev says, a bright light has gone out. Pete personified hope, peace, and respect for nature and human rights. He'll live forever in song and spirit, and he will. Hefe writes, rest in peace, Pete Seeger, a true free spirit. Neil, Pete Seeger's spirit lives on in my heart. And how many would say that? I mean, just on and on. Heather says, so loved by so many. Northeaster says the guy had vision and he had guts. What a life. And Alan writing to us here, I think of the reuniting of Pete and his longtime friend Woody Guthrie, and of all those gone on before, what an amazing jam session it must be, thinking up there at the Pearly Gates right now, John.
It must be a jam. You know, Pete's been preparing for this day for years and years, singing songs about being an elder. And he did a good job. There's a big hole in the heart of the American in this world, but we need to fill it with song. That's what he would have wanted.
Got an email here from Eva, and she writes, and remember, of course, Pete Seeger in the 50s was brought before the Congress and ended up being blacklisted for his politics. He offered to sing. He wouldn't testify. I thought it was un-American to be asked to. She writes to us, about 30 years ago, I was the librarian at a small elementary school in Poughkeepsie, New York. On a whim, I invited Pete Seeger to our school and was very surprised when he accepted. He sang, told stories, enchanted everyone. While I was driving him back, I asked him why he came to our school rather than to a larger, more public venue. He told me that in the 50s, he had been scheduled to appear at that very school to sing to the children, but the Board of Education had rescinded the invitation because of his appearance before the Senate committee. He smiled and said, here I am, after all. Eva writes to us, I wept today when I heard of his passing, a true American hero. Rob Rosenthal, I think he well qualifies.
Absolutely. You know, when we were doing this research for our book and going through the thousands and thousands of letters in his house, what was so striking was that letter after letter came from people saying, Pete, I'm involved in this struggle here. Pete, I'm involved in this struggle here. I'm in jail. I'm whatever it was, but your music is what helps me to keep going. And these were from people all over the world. I think all over the world today, people are thinking, what a person, what a life.
Yeah, Steve, I can't get to all these callers. Steve in Nashville says he inspired his whole life, Pete Seeger. Dennis in Thompson, Georgia, spent time with Pete Seeger. He rode the bus like everybody else, Dennis reminds us. We're really grateful to the two of you, Rob Rosenthal at Wesleyan. Pete Seeger in his own words is the book. Rob, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And John McCutcheon, great folk musician, storyteller in his own right. John, thank you for your memories of Pete Seeger.
Oh, thank you for doing this show.
We go out with a live performance of Pete Seeger's great protest song, We Shall Overcome. Rest in peace, Pete Seeger. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.